Hello and welcome to another Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show for the last 5 years, as well as founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that provides support to those looking to integrate complementary and lifestyle medicine into their treatment protocol. My guest this week is someone I've only recently become aware of. She's highly qualified in both conventional and lifestyle medicine and has a clinic not far from Winchester where she specialises in supporting women with breast cancer through treatment and beyond. I'm speaking to Dr. Nina Fuller-Chavelle over the internet in Stockbridge. Hi Dr. Nina, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
So to me, you're part of a pretty clearly defined army of people who are changing the face of medicine right now. This army consists almost exclusively of women who have all faced some serious health issue themselves. They've found that conventional medicine either had no answers or at least insufficient answers for them, and they've regained their health through approaches they've found for themselves. And then they've gone outside to train themselves, often very highly indeed, as in your case, and are now helping others with a whole broad range of chronic conditions that kind of characterise public health in 21st century Britain. So would you tell us about your particular story? What led you on this journey to become an integrative doctor?
Sure. I think my journey started actually quite early on. If I think back to my childhood, I was born in Belarus, and Russia and Belarus and sort of the that side of the world is quite big into herbal medicine. And nutrition is also a very, very big part of our lives. So again, fresh food, seasonal living and herbal medicine was probably part of my life from a very early age. My nan, for example, literally grew most of her own food, and there was actually a bit of a barter system in the village, so properly old school. When I came over to the UK, it was quite an interesting experience, I have to say. Boarding school food did not endear me to British cuisine.
I bet. I remember
in any way, shape or form. I was like, I don't recognise this as food. What is this stuff? And then I really got into running, so long distance running. I really enjoyed sports at school, and I did swimming and tennis and running. And as I went on to study natural sciences at Cambridge, again, I did a bit more sort of competitive running, long distance running, and started thinking how I can fuel my body really properly for sport, more sports nutrition side of things. And then I went on into work and worked in London, quite really, really long hours doing medical education. So actually teaching doctors about various things from medications to liver disease. And during that time, I found it very tricky working kind of, I guess, probably between 10 and 16 hour days, anything between 5 and 6 days a week for quite a long period of time. And I crashed and I had a really big decline in health, and they diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome. But I very rapidly realized that chronic fatigue syndrome is a rather useless label that tells you nothing about the underlying causes of what your fatigue actually is. And then through my own journey, I found out a lot more about nutrition. So instead of making it more about fueling the sports side of things, it was much more about how do I recover from this? Conventional medicine doesn't have any answers for chronic fatigue syndrome, so what do I do to support myself? And luckily, over the period of sort of 6 to 9 months, I came out of that was very much around restoring actually my HPA or adrenal axis, and reading some Sarah Michael's work. I then decided I wanted to train in nutrition, so I trained at the Institute of Optimum Nutrition while I was still working. And then I was like, well, nutrition is great, but I need to know more about medicine. I need to know how to kind of treat the complicated end of the spectrum. So I decided to go back to Cambridge again and did my second degree there and did graduate course in medicine. While I was doing that, because I did my nutrition in a very much of a functional medicine way, and that's very much root cause-based approaches, I sort of did other trainings all throughout with the Institute of Functional Medicine and some of the UK-based providers in terms of keeping myself up to date. And then I came to the end of my medical degree, went into junior doctor world, and I was going, oh, hold on a second. My two worlds collide rather badly together.
Too right.
I was like, I can't believe this. And here I am being called, you know, to the patient's bedside with a blood sugar of, you know, 22. And there's a massive packet of Tucks next to them. And, you know, I've got to drop everything and rush to this medical emergency. And it is just this, I guess, fundamental lack of awareness in the medical world, really, about nutrition and the power of that. In all of my medical training throughout Cambridge, which is amazing, an amazing medical school, but we only had 2 hours, 2 hours in years and years of training.
Unbelievable.
And it shocked me to the core, because what I was realizing is that because of my previous background, again, in natural sciences and nutrition, I was looking at things in a very, very different way. I don't look at people as diagnostic boxes. I very much look at the whole physiology, and we also look at healthcare rather than sick care. Mm. So the more I worked in the kind of the sick care system, actually, that's caused me to become sick myself. So at that time, I went off with breast cancer, and I went through conventional treatment, but I very much supported myself through everything I could throw at it as well. So I went through 6 months of chemotherapy, two surgeries, and luckily it's all in remission now. But again, another encounter on the patient side for me was when I was sitting there in the chemo lounge, there was literally no advice. The advice was so basic and bland on anything you can do to support yourself. Mm. And you expect to just hand over all of your power to the gods of medicine and go, right, you fix me. And the problem is that we know that patients who are diagnosed with cancers, I felt, you need to take some control of the situation, do something to help yourself. And we also know that chemo has awful, and other modalities like radiotherapy have significant side effects, to which, again, medicine does not have an answer. Mm-hmm. But there is research, and certainly both mechanistic and very early human research, that shows us what we can do to support ourselves through the process. So alongside my conventional treatment, I used nutrition, I used acupuncture, I used herbal medicine, I used yoga and mindfulness. I threw the book at it. And actually, in the process, both my plastic surgeon, who did my reconstruction after my breast cancer surgery, and my oncology surgeon and my oncologist were all quite amazed about what the process of supporting yourself truly brings to the table. Hmm. So actually, they've started recommending to people that they do look at other way of supporting themselves. And I'm very lucky. I had an amazing team at the Royal Marsden Hospital. I'm going to be eternally grateful to them. But it's brilliant, because I think it's opened our discussions and opened our eyes to what you can really, really do.
You were in a very unique position there, really, in a way, where you got training in nutrition and functional medicine, you've got training in orthodox medicine, and now you're the patient. And that is a very rare combination, in fact, and it put you in this extraordinary position to get people to open their eyes and ears to something new, because there's so many people we know who talk to them all the time who would hope that their oncologist would be interested in what they're doing because it's helping so much, but that's not the case. They're not, almost universally not interested, and the very best response that any of them will ever get is the kind of great, well, what you're doing seems to be working fine, just keep on with it. That's a really good response, but they will never get interest. So yeah, well, excellent that you were able to do that, and I hope that you're able to further that.
And actually, since then, obviously, one thing that I've realised personally for myself, it's been a bit of a wake up call that actually my two worlds probably don't work that well together, and I really need to just come out of the NHS and actually do a bit of innovation within my own system, effectively. So. Mm-hmm. That's after completing some further training after my breast cancer treatment, I've decided to come out of the NHS, and I now run Synthesis Clinic, and that's a functional integrative medicine practice in Hampshire. And the way that, again, I take mostly breast cancer cases in terms of the oncology side of it, although we also take care of gut health and other women's health issues. And that's been really, really very interesting because, again, I try and collaborate and bring the team as much together as possible. I speak to my patients' oncologists if they are open to the conversation, or I can write to them, and I coordinate my care very much with the whole team. Mm-hmm. I think there is, like you said, a benefit to, number one, me being having gone through it, I feel what it's like to be on treatment. I've been there with chemo. I know how sick you feel, and I know also what can help and what doesn't help.
Right.
But also because quite often the oncologists then speak to another doctor sometimes, and I know it's probably necessarily not the right thing to do, but sometimes just speaking the common language and me pointing them to direction of some of the PubMed trials and some of the things that I found work in my clinical practice can push people's envelope a little bit and open up their eyes a little bit further.
Right. Very interesting. I wondered if you mind talking a little bit more. Is an area that interests me very much is the different worlds of orthodox medicine, complementary medicine, and men and women working in those and being patients in those, in fact. And I mentioned in the outset that the army of people who are taking the role that you are nearly all women. They are. And, I mean, the background of complementary medicine is women's medicine by women for women. You know, that's what's happening. And it is changing, but very slowly. And it's a tragedy that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, because men, of course, make fantastic complementary practitioners. Men make great patients in as much as they benefit enormously from everything that lifestyle and complementary medicine can offer. So it's a tragedy on both sides that that's not happening. On the other side, there's another tragedy happening, which is that my experience is that whereas you've come along there and you've made a difference as a woman by presenting a different face of, you know, what's possible for patients, you've introduced it as a professional. In oncology generally, I understand there are now more women professionals working in oncology than men. But nonetheless, they have taken on the role of the traditional oncology mantle, the one that's been handed down, which is a sort of top-down, rather abusive system. And some of the worst interactions between oncologists and patients are actually with a woman oncologist. So it's like, oh, no, you know, they're even worse than the men. So that system doesn't seem to have been changed by it so far, particularly, you know, the introduction of this kind of other way of looking at medicine, which incorporates care and empathy and a whole view of a person, doesn't seem to really infiltrate it into oncology yet, which I'm very disappointed about, but I really hope it does soon.
It's a tricky situation. I think we are still very much at the very early stages of any of this changing, actually. If you're thinking about integrative medicine and integrative care, really US kind of leads the way in that, and in the UK we're quite, and Germany, yeah, if you think about closer to us in Europe, Germany, but certainly within the UK we're way far behind. I mean, we are just about opening our eyes in sort of GP and NHS land to lifestyle medicine. Isn't the soft option that it does actually make a big difference, that you can reverse pre-diabetes with doing lifestyle medicine, and you don't need to keep everybody on metformin. So I think we really are just peeking into that area, and I think it's too early, unfortunately, Robin, to see those changes permeate all the way through the culture. And you also have to think a little bit about most sort of particularly older consultants, older female consultants have had to go through a really rough culture.
I know. It's a rough culture, exactly. That's why I called it abusive. I think the inspiration which so many young people go into learning to train to be a doctor, who want to help people, who have got all the right motivation, everything else, and want to care for people who are in terrible circumstances, a lot of that is just knocked out of them in the first 3 years, you know. You know, I've heard it from people themselves who've been through it, and it's just like being part of the army. You know, we're gonna toughen them up, and it's terrible. And when are we going to stop doing this? It's like so, you know, out of date. You know, it's the way everything ran sometime in the 1930s, But it should be just something left in the past now.
Yeah, and I think there's some, I said, early changes coming towards it, and we're looking more at physician resilience. Wonderful friend and colleague, Dr. Sally Moorcroft, set up a program that's looking very much at building physician resilience, because ultimately, if physicians and doctors don't take care of themselves and we don't actually learn to build resilience, are we going to burn out and compassion fatigue? And our patients don't deserve that. They don't deserve us being burnt out and unable to offer empathy, because that's ultimately what we're there for. We have, through mechanistic way of practicing medicine, we've lost the art of medicine. We've lost the art of being able to actually relate to human, not just patient to in bed 2.1 with a chest infection. And I'm seeing more and more, I like to think, positive changes. There's a British Society of Lifestyle Medicine that is very much furthering the cause of lifestyle medicine. I think hopefully, and the more, again, that's what I'm trying to do, the more I can do from the clinic and try and collaborate with local researchers and local organizations to show people that this approach works and works for people. I mean, one of my cases, for example, is, she's an amazing lady. She's got triple negative breast cancer that's metastatic. And the little bit like you said about the approach people encounter, Robin, is she sees oncologists, and she's had this disease for 5 years plus, I think, for around about 5 years. And they keep telling her, oh, you must have a weird slow-growing triple negative cancer. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's not a weird, never been described slow-growing triple negative. The aggression's being slowed down and tempered by everything we throw at it, both from the conventional medicine side and everything I throw at it from the integrative medicine side and everything she's doing herself. So I'd like, and I'm with you completely, the curiosity about this should be there, because we need to know. We need to know what works. We know there's some stuff on, we know all our stats about chemo. We know our stats about radio. Okay, what about combining that? What about the quality of life? The information is actually, a lot of it is out there in PubMed. It's just we're not looking. As clinicians, actually, we should be looking at what else we can do to keep our patients more whole, more resilient, empowered through the whole process.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of our hard-worked oncologists would never accept, I mean, if you told them that they were totally uncaring, they would be very shocked to hear that and would probably deny it. And you can see why. But in fact, to actually ignore the entire gamut of natural science that enables patients to go through chemotherapy in a way which is far, far less horrendous and far less damaging in the long term, just to ignore the whole thing and just given some more drugs to manage the side effects, which have side effects themselves, is, you know, it's uncaring, actually. That's the fact. So, you know, it's an odd world that we have. But I'm very pleased that you point out that actually, whereas it seems like a situation in some cases where it's all about the oncologist and they're just having the life they want, you know, and everybody has to fit around them, in fact, it's hell for them as well.
It's very tricky. I think the other thing we've got to realize, and again, having worked in the NHS myself, it is immensely draining quite often, certainly, particularly in the early years. Like you said, I could be the only doctor on call outside of A&E for all of the medical wards in the District General Hospital.
Wow.
Me. Right. Okay. And my registrar would have been in A&E dealing with someone. Yeah. I would have had literally no help. So if someone decides to have a cardiac arrest on one side of the hospital and someone decides to have another emergency on the other.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. And at that point, yes, you do reach almost a mechanistic way of approaching the problem and what has to be fixed, because you're firefighting all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the system of our system of medicine is very much has been built on a maladapted acute medicine system.
Yeah.
So when Bevan created the NHS, it was very much acute medical work. You know, thinking about that, post-Second World War, lots of acute medicine problems, lots of infections. And it's great. Our medical model works very well for these things. Absolutely. You know, if you've broken
it's fantastic.
A leg,
yeah.
You're sorted.
I agree.
But the problem is we now no longer live in that world. We live in a world where non-communicable disease, chronic disease is absolutely rife. And for that, we don't have a clear answer because the acute medicine model breaks down at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's where the systems medicine, systems biology has so much to offer.
Yeah.
And looking at the wide angle, like you said, you know, looking at the natural healthcare research, looking at lifestyle and bringing all of this together. Because I'm a big believer in the fact that we don't need to throw any babies out with the bathwater. We just need to learn to coexist happily and respect each other's you know, expertise and knowledge, really.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. Thank you for that. Yeah. Okay, so coming back to your work, one of your main things, supporting women with breast cancer. So in your own experience, what were the greatest gaps in care that you needed to find help with during your treatment?
Nutrition, I think, was one that really shocked me because I had, and it's not the, if I didn't have my background, I would like to correct that. If I didn't have my background, I would find it really dire and lacking. And that's at the one of the top cancer hospitals.
Right.
Because the advice is eat a balanced diet. I'm like, well, what is a balanced diet? A chocolate in each hand? A chocolate in each hand could be a balanced diet. And, you know, there's biscuits in the chemo lounge. And you're kind of going, okay, where is good quality advice on what to eat? And how you, what you can do to support yourself. And there really wasn't any. The other things I think that is important is, no, I don't think there's enough awareness about anything that can be done to support your blood counts, for example, during chemotherapy. So I regularly put in a number of things to support my patients' blood counts so they don't have to have their chemo delayed, for example, if they keep dropping them. But there wasn't anything apart from the usual G-CSF injections that anyone would even consider.
Right.
And the problem is, as patients go through chemotherapy, what we certainly know from research is that, particularly in breast cancer, is that actually they drop muscle mass, they can gain fat, and that has a prognostic significance. But because of the lack of dietary advice or anything else, you're finding, actually, I'd like to know at the front of my treatment if what I'm going to be going through is going to affect my survival and what I can do to support myself.
Right.
So that was probably the biggest gap, really. Just good, solid advice in nutrition was a big problem.
Yeah, well, I have to say the Marsden still puts out a big warning to people not to consult those nasty nutritionists who might give them unqualified advice about cancer and nutrition. But, you're right. It's a scary territory. And I think that that support of the immune system you mentioned is one of the massive negations of orthodox medicine. I remember when I set up Yes to Life, there was a 700-page report by, I think it was Cancer Research UK, on medicinal mushrooms, almost the whole of it positive, you know, as to its capacity to support the immune system. And it was already several years old, I think, at that time, that report. So it's not like they don't know anything about it. But would they use mushrooms in, you know, in our wards, our oncology wards? No, well, it's not a drug, is it? We don't use mushrooms here. It's an absolute tragedy that something as simple, cheap and effective as that is completely and utterly ignored.
And the other thing is, when we think about medicinal mushrooms, we, you know, our culinary mushrooms are medicinal. You know, you can go and buy your shiitake in your supermarket and put it in your stir fry, along with your broccoli and other things.
Yeah.
I think what we do have to realize, and again, that's where I sit in between both worlds. What I know is a huge amount of research that oncologists have to get through just on the conventional drugs is massive.
Yeah.
The amount of trials that are coming out every year is huge. So when you consider all of this professional development, the answer really possibly in our system isn't that the oncologist has to know about all these things. It's that they're willing to work in a team who have the expertise to use these things safely and effectively in combination with treatment.
Yeah, well, I agree. That's how it should work, Yeah, you're
otherwise,
right.
You can't expect oncologists to take on board the whole of the stuff that I have trouble keeping up with.
Right. No, I absolutely agree with you. Yes, you can't expect them to be functional medicine practitioners as well. But they need to open their minds to the idea there are other people who are also very skilled, also very professional, and can also help a lot.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think collaboration is a big thing, even within my own clinic. You know, I don't expect to do everything myself.
No.
I've got a health coach who helps people implement nutritional changes. I've got an amazing psychologist who I work with very closely. So it's, I think teams are the way to go, and we should think about multidisciplinary teams wider than the occasional oncology MDT and the NHS. You know, we can build those things and build integrative centres of care that are much further along in other countries, unfortunately.
Yeah, agree. Okay, so probably all of those shortcomings come from the way in which health's viewed, in which cancer is viewed. I mean, is the body's viewed in a kind of reductionistic way, or cancer's viewed as a tumour that's got to be killed or cut out, then the treatment is going to reflect exactly that view. So what you were finding, I'm guessing, is that your view of your own health and needs wasn't being reflected in, by the system of healthcare, or at the best, it was only being partly reflected, and so you were led to look elsewhere. Well, of course, in fact, you already had some of your own resources to look to, unlike most people, which was very lucky in a way. But the good news these days is there are increasingly well-established and trustworthy places where people can go and look for that kind of extra help. Would you agree that these gaps in care have always been there, but up until recently, most people have simply had to accept what they were given?
Yeah, I would think so. I think these days we have a lot more education available to us. We've got, ultimately, we've got accessible information from all over the world. The Arizona University has an integrative medicine center where both patients and clinicians can take online programs on integrative cancer management. So there's a number of different resources available now. People are looking, I think there's much more activation within ourselves as a patient group that we want to have a say in our healthcare, actually. And we're no longer, maybe our parents' generation, going, yes, sir, of course, sir. And,
right.
And sort of, yes, doctor, I'm not going to ask any questions. I have no idea why I'm taking this drug.
Right. That's simply not good enough anymore, is it? And one thing you've written yourself, which is obviously very important to you, which speaks to me of a different view of medicine, is that you talk about tackling root causes, not just plastering over symptoms. So that seems to me somewhere where you feel orthodox medicine is doing something in many situations which is not your approach at all, or doesn't reflect your view of health.
Absolutely. And I think that's again where the shift comes from acute to chronic medicine.
Right.
If you think about even the conventional approach, conventional medicine, the acute medicine treats the cause. So acute medicine, if you've got a chest infection, they're going to treat you for pneumonia and then you're going to get better.
Right.
But when we've chronic medicine, our drugs don't treat the root causes very much anymore. They treat some aspects of our physiology, but they don't address why disease arose in the first place.
Right.
And I see it with everything from, you know, the whole COVID discussion and all of it. We should treat the terrain. We should treat the body as a whole system and actually look at the environment. That's tumorigenic. What is it about the environment? What combination of genetics, lifestyle, and other factors has contributed to an environment where our own defenses in terms of immune defense, apoptosis, natural cancer defenses don't work anymore? If they fail, why do they fail? So what can we do to support ourselves back out of it? And my thing about as well, recurrence, I guess, my recurrence management isn't just, oh, well, let's just go for annual surveillance or whatever surveillance program you're on.
Right.
It's let's look back. Let's look at maybe some of the personalized medicine aspects. Let's look at genetics of your estrogen metabolism, for example. Let's look at the family history. Let's look at the lifestyle. What combination of lifestyle could have potentially contributed to increased risk of your either immune system not being good enough or actually, you know, suppressive of your responses? And how can we make these all better so we're creating a completely different body environment, that we're not just cut out the cancer and just left a vacuum there and go, well, right, hey, that's it, you're done.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it seems common sense to me, but it isn't the kind of ethos, is it? There's actually the question of why people got cancer is simply not even asked. It's people are able to still say, oh, it's just bad luck, you know, despite the fact that statistics are completely out of control, you know, and now half of us predicted to get cancer. So it's an astonishing kind of world we live in.
Well, we can't, again, I don't think we can properly say, oh, it's just bad luck, because actually the World Cancer Research Fund very clearly states that over 60% of cancers are prevented by lifestyle intervention.
Right.
So it can be prevented. So I think that's something that we definitely need to look into. But again, as I said, it's not made it to the mainstream, the lifestyle being thought of as a soft option, you know. Drugs are the proper medicine.
Right. Exactly.
But actually, chronic disease gets created every day, ultimately. If you're thinking about it, cancers grow over years or decades.
Yes.
So chronic disease, what choices do we make every day impact our risk. So what we should do about it should be done every day.
Right. Very good point. Thank you. Yeah. So you're trained in and you offer a broad range of approaches. They're clearly aimed at filling the kind of gaps in care that you've experienced. Is there one of those approaches or areas of care that you feel is more important than all the rest? And if so, why?
Bobby, it's like asking me to pick a favourite child. You can't.
Well, I don't know. If you haven't got an answer, then you haven't. It's fair enough. But maybe you have.
I don't think it's the approach itself in terms of therapeutic modality.
No, but an area of care.
Yeah. I would say functional medicine.
Yeah.
It's the root-based approach. And that's, to me, is the most crucial thing. Because actually, you can use even conventional medicine, you can use medication that I sometimes do, where you're targeting the root cause. But it's having that mindset of going, I'm going to look at all of your physiological system as a whole human being, everything together. And I'm going to target the roots rather than going, basically, rather than playing whack-a-mole
right.
with drugs and symptoms.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, thank you. So let's say here I am. I'm a woman with breast cancer. I've literally just heard the news that I've got cancer. I've got no idea what's ahead of me, but I'm scared stiff of the treatment and what it may involve. I'm scared stiff of not knowing whether it's likely to work or not. This is a big question, I realise, but just say that by chance I call you up on day one, all right, and I've just been diagnosed. What, how, when are you able to help along the way? In what ways?
So I change my approaches depending on the treatment that's chosen and conventional side as well, very right. much so. But I think from day one, I always put in, ultimately, a Mediterranean-style, high phytonutrient diet. That's got to be the cornerstone of whatever you're going through, because that provides you with the building blocks and nutrients you need to actually keep your body as healthy as possible throughout. Then, for example, if someone is going into surgery, say, within the next couple of weeks, which quite often happens if they've found a kind of a local, locally contained tumour, then we would very much look at prepping for surgery and surgery rehab. And during that time, I would optimise someone's protein status in particular. Lots of women aren't aware that having sufficient but not excessive protein intake is very important around recovery from surgery and chemotherapy, because both of these things increase your protein requirement. Mm-hmm. So it's about then supporting them through it, finding them a very good rehab specialist. So there's amazing stuff in terms of pink ribbon approaches and other things that you can regain your shoulder mobility post-mastectomy, for example, and lymph node surgery, to a really good level. And the key thing is to do it preventatively rather than wait until problems arise later on. Oh, no, I actually can't move my shoulder. Is to build a program from the very beginning.
Right.
If we were going into chemo, my approach is, again, is phased very much about in terms of what is appropriate for chemotherapy. So, for example, I don't use probiotics because they're not considered safe in chemotherapy. But I might be able to use probiotics later on when we're rebuilding the gut after chemotherapy has completed. But I would then use very specific rotating regimes according to the chemo cycle in terms of supporting blood cell counts, making sure people get adequate nutrition. If their appetite or their ability to digest food has been impaired by chemotherapy. So that's very, very important. Gentle movement throughout, again, helping people find movement that works for them, that doesn't exhaust them, but you've got to keep moving because one of the main predictors of profound cancer-related and chemo-related fatigue is stopping moving.
Right.
And actually, you can do anything from yin yoga and restorative yoga, which is very little, very, very gentle stuff, to Tai Chi, to other things. You can find something that you can do, however sick you feel, and it will actually help you feel better. So that's kind of the other things that I do. Herbal medicine, I use a fair amount of. You mentioned medicinal mushrooms, whether it's in dietary form or in other forms, we use that as well with patients. And radiotherapy, again, so radiotherapy, you then go into very specific challenges here in terms of skin protection. So sometimes there's some local things that can be done, as well as actually helping with radiotherapy-related fatigue. So you kind of chop and change depending on the stage of treatment and what the person in front of you needs. There isn't a protocol. I treat people. Sure. I don't treat protocols.
Sure. But it's interesting. I mean, the mindset that, well, let's go back to when I first set up Yes to Life. Most of the people we talked to literally had every drop of chemo their body was able to take, being irradiated to the point of being fried, and there was nothing more on offer, and then they turn up at the door asking for help. And that has changed over the years. The likelihood of somebody doing what I suggested, of ringing up somebody like you on day one now, or us, is actually far greater than it was, and it does happen, which is marvellous, because of course there is a mindset which still goes, well, I'm going to get the conventional treatment done and then I'll start all that stuff, sort of thing. You know, that mindset is still around, and I, of course, people who know other what's possible hold their head, because of course they've actually just dished the whole of integrated medicine, which is the combination of the two things, and what can happen if they're used together. And that's a total tragedy for them that they've done that. So of course, to have the opportunity to talk to somebody on day one is marvelous for anybody who has this knowledge. So I'm just interested, is that common for you to be able to do that?
So it's becoming more common, I would say. Most of the time, if I think about the proportion of breast cancer cases I get, most of them would be either just before or just after surgery, actually. Right. So they probably had a couple of weeks to process things. They're looking to support themselves in a different way. And actually, then when they go back to see their surgeon, for example, afterwards, I've had some really great responses as well. We mustn't tie everybody with the same brush. I've had some amazing oncology surgeons who were so impressed with how the patient is actually better having had breast cancer than they were feeling before. And then they were like, oh, okay, that can happen. And they will take that very much on board. But yes, vast majority, probably not day one, I would say. That's a very small proportion, probably under 10%. Most of the time it's around surgery or just post-surgery.
Well, that's very good though, isn't it? I mean, that's excellent. That's certainly around the beginning. Anyway, that's the time when you can really start to help. And so that's marvellous. And it's very good that people have that mindset now, where they don't just sort of turn up, you know, your chemo starts on Monday, and they just turn up and get on with it. And then a week later, they find they're on another planet, drugged to death, you know, and they wouldn't even be able to think about consulting anybody else. So it's very good that that's the case, and shows a change in the public culture, if not in the medical culture.
Absolutely. And also all the amazing work that organizations like yours have done about educating people about the fact that there are things that can help. And I actually love to see stuff in the mainstream medical journals. So in the last couple of years, there have been a publications in oncology journals about integrative approach to breast cancer, for example. And I can see acupuncture being recommended.
Right.
And I think there is far more of this. Certainly the ASCO, so American Society for Oncology, is yes. bringing in some guidelines on integrative medicine, which I find brilliant, because you can then hopefully pass all of these along to our colleagues and help spread the word.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's certainly true. There are one or two things which have sort of caught the attention of the mainstream world, which are, you know, straight out of alternative medicine. All of a sudden they're there, the gut health being one of them. It's like, you know, where was that in conventional medicine even 3 or 4 years ago? It just didn't exist. And suddenly it's like, well, this drug works 50% better if you do this, you know. And that's been pretty extraordinary, I think. And the other one that has been around in oncology, of course, forever, but is actually that there's the place you don't go, is that, of course, all dietary approaches to cancer have been completely attacked to death as being piffle until the ketogenic diet came along, which has actually started to be taken seriously, which is a breakthrough, really, and has opened the door to the fact, well, actually, there is some connection between diet and cancer. Would you believe it? And you know, it is making its way in there. You're right.
And gut health is a huge one, and that's actually where all of my specialties of the clinic, and that's sort of gut health, hormones and women's health, and mental health and well-being all come together.
Right.
Because actually our gut is an absolute epicenter for all of this. And in fact, from the breast cancer point of view, we know that having a certain amount of antibiotics in life may slightly increase your risk of getting breast cancer and may potentially increase your risk of recurrence. So if we're thinking about restoring people's guts post-chemotherapy, it's absolutely crucial, because right. we know that a significant amount of estrogen recycling goes on in the gut. And your bacterial balance is going to affect what goes on. It's called enterohepatic recirculation, and something I've never learned about in medical school, but it's all over the journals.
Right, right. You're right. It's fascinating stuff, and it's so important. And, you know, and all of it comes back to a very basic, some sort of faith in the systems that are there already in us, you know, that are inbuilt systems that actually work better than any kind of thing we can do. But the thing we can do is support those systems and get them to work as well as they can, which I think we have a lot of power to do with using our intellect in exploring the ways, the resources that are out in the world to improve our own internal resources. And, you know, and I think it's a whole world that is, we've learnt a massive amount in the last 25 years, I think, where science has started to take this stuff seriously. 25 years ago, most people who worked in this field, because they intuitively felt this was the right place to go, that nature had a lot of the answers, and that, you know, we did have a system that wasn't self-destructive and could heal itself and all these kind of things, was, you know, that it was a slightly airy-fairy world. But now, of course, there's a huge amount of science to back it up as well. So its position has shifted significantly, I think.
I find it really fascinating, actually. From my perspective, I look to all sorts of different sources of information, and I look at some of the herbs that have always been used in traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine for yes. very many, literally hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's fascinating because, of course, now China's putting lots of these herbs through high throughput screening and molecular biology and finding out exactly why they work,
right?
Which is fascinating. And the same for Ayurveda. And I think it's brilliant because ultimately those systems were observational systems of medicine, whereby you were pattern recognizing. You would see something, you'd go, this is a pattern. I don't care what it's called, stagnant qi or anything else, but
right.
Do you see what I mean? But I can now correlate it very much to actually what's going on in my physiological world. And we can say, okay, someone's got deficient qi, I can say actually their HPA or adrenal axis is dysregulated, for example. And you can correlate all of these things. So you can take observational systems of medicine that basically figured out, in the absence of any other science of what worked. And now we can actually put the science behind and go, right, this is why it works. It's because of ginsenoside or this particular thing.
Yeah.
But there's a danger in that as well, I think, because what we mustn't do is we mustn't become reductionist in, right, in our approach to things.
Right.
That's because the danger of us going down and digging into all of these little molecular chemistry is for us to forget that nature has created these compounds to all function together. And by taking one and just taking it out and using it in high doses, it's going to have a very different effect to the actual whole plant complex.
Thank you for bringing that back in. It's very important, isn't it? You're absolutely right. Nature has something as a whole that you can't be ignored. A piece of broccoli is more than the sum of its ingredients. So, very important. But what a fascinating topic. Look, we're right out of time. I really enjoyed that. It was real fun. Thank you so much, Dr. Nina. Love to have you back again sometime. I'm sure there's lots more we can talk about. But thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Robin. It was great. Bye.
Bye-bye. I'm sure there are many of you listening who would love to have been able to gain the interest of your oncologist in the integrative medicine approaches that you use in the way that Dr. Nina was able to due to her medical standing. This intensely frustrating situation of being locked into an exclusively drug culture in healthcare is an ongoing tragedy that both the patients and the providers are the victims of. All I can say is to encourage you, if you're someone going through cancer, to look for opportunities to make your oncologist aware of the massive potential for improving the lot of their patients that they're overlooking. Show them the science. Point out the ways in which you're benefiting. Obviously, there's no mileage in getting into a confrontation with a closed door, but if you sense the slightest opening, why not use the opportunity? The Yes to Life website has had some upgrades recently, and one of the great new features is a searchable page for the Yes to Life show. There are now over 250 shows available, but the growing problem has been one of accessibility, finding the material or the guests that you're interested in. Well, I'm delighted that this has been addressed with this new search page. Go to yestolife.org.uk, scroll down the homepage and click where it says Yes to Life show. There you'll find details of the current show, but also most of the last 5 years' shows, some of the earliest ones are still being added, with search boxes that allow you to look for subjects, guests or keywords. Each result is linked directly to the show on Listen On Demand on UK Health Radio. I'd also like to remind you of the ongoing fortnightly live forums now taking place within Wigwam, the Yes to Life Cancer Support Group. Look on wigwam.org.uk for details of the upcoming forums and recordings of past forums. Next up will be an exciting presentation and Q&A on mushroom bioscience, not to be missed. Just take a look under events at wigwam.org.uk to reserve your place at this free forum. Thanks so much for listening today. I'll be back again next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.